This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Zach Williams read his story, Neighbors, from the March 25th, 2024 issue of the magazine. Williams is a Jones Lecturer in Fiction at Stanford University. His debut story collection, Beautiful Days, will be published in June. Now here's Zach Williams.
Neighbors. Not long after our twins turned three, my wife, Anna, accepted a transfer to the West Coast. The opportunity was lucrative, but that wasn't why we were eager to go. Anna had spent that March and April involved with another man, a colleague, someone whose name I'd never heard until she told me about him. She said that it had been a terrible mistake, that it had only made her hate herself, and that this person had now begun almost to frighten her, continuing to call after she'd asked him to stop, declaring that he'd leave his family, demanding to speak with me. I was surprised to find that, more than anything, I felt sorry for her. The episode was the culmination of a long withdrawal that each of us had made from the other. For some time, our mutual unhappiness had felt like too delicate or intimate a subject to broach. I knew I wasn't blameless. The hard-to-fathom part really was that she'd hidden it from me. It felt so old-fashioned, predicated on such a rigid understanding of who we could be together. In bed, in the dark, I told her that if we wanted to try again, we would have to redraw the map. We spent the days that followed talking more openly than we had in years, about our girls, our childhoods, old lovers, doubts and desires we'd each been afraid to confess. In San Francisco, we found a house in the Outer Sunset, four blocks east of the Pacific. The neighborhood was row after row of small townhouses, all with the same footprint in sun-bleached pastels. Most of them had been built in the 30s, which was not long after the area had been known as the Outside Lands, desolate and windswept, just scattered people growing vegetables in the shifting dunes. We'd been warned against the sunset because of the cold and fog that often settled there. But on clear days, we woke to pristine ocean views. There was a walking path by the beach that led north to Golden Gate Park and south to the zoo. The girls would run ahead, holding hands, leaning close sometimes to whisper, and we'd push the stroller behind them. They could talk with just the barest application of language. They really did have that preternatural intimacy I'd always heard about in twins. After they'd gone to bed, Anna and I would sit on the deck with some wine or a joint and watch the sunset. It felt good to be there. I told her which of my friends I'd always been slightly in love with. She told me that she'd never stopped silently reciting the nightly prayers she'd learned as a child. I asked her once what she'd wanted from her relationship with this other person, what she'd hoped might be possible. The question made her laugh. She said, "Ecstasy? A miracle? I don't know." Weekdays, Anna dropped the girls at school before driving to work. I made an office out of our downstairs mother-in-law unit, built into the garage's back corner, and stayed home. Soon I felt attuned to the place, the way it sounded and felt across time. Surfers jogged down the hill every morning carrying their boards. Deep in the night, sometimes the sinking moon lit up the ocean. People were friendly. Hal and Eleni were our neighbors to the right. Early on, they rang our bell with flowers and a cheerfully annotated map of the neighborhood printed from Google in black and white. Across the street from us was another young family who seemed very nice. We resolved to take our kids to the playground together someday, but never did. And in the house to our left, there was an elderly woman who lived alone. Hal said that her name was Bing. Weeks passed before we met Bing, though we often heard her. She had a booming cough and a landline phone with an old-fashioned clapper that seemed to be mounted on our shared wall. All night long, she played her television at ear-splitting levels. I assumed she slept in front of it. Now and then, I'd see her from our bedroom window, hanging laundry on her back patio. She was hunched and overweight and used a walker, and the whole sad spectacle, the way she'd labored to get the basket of wet clothes out the door at the back of her garage, let it drop onto the plastic table there, then hang each article one by one, was hard to watch. I've always been a bad sleeper, and sometimes as I was lying awake at 4 or 5, a sudden glare through the window would startle me, the motion-activated spotlight over Bing's back door. I imagined that if I got out of bed and walked to the window, I would see her on the patio, dressed for the day, making her slow, lonely progress at something or other. One Saturday in September, on our way out the door to Point Reyes with the girls, we found a conversion van parked in front of Bing's house. A man our age, 40 or so, was there helping Bing up into the back seat of the van. It was our first opportunity to say hello, so we loitered in our driveway as he braced his shoulder against her, rubbing her back very tenderly as she climbed, her entire body trembling. Trying not to watch, I set my eyes on the walker, which stood alone on the sidewalk. The man got Bing seated, helped buckle her in, then jogged over to introduce himself. As we talked, Bing smiled out at us, leaning forward to see through the van's side door. His name was Henry, he said. He was Bing's youngest. He'd grown up there in the house beside ours and now lived in State Line, Nevada, where he was a rock climber. I thought he looked too put together for that, with his unwrinkled golf shirt tucked into khaki shorts. But the van, I saw, was rugged and full of gear. In that Californian way to which I was still becoming accustomed, Henry seemed authentically pleased to meet us. He wanted to know if I played tennis. There were courts behind the high school, and he had his racket in the van. He'd come home to take Bing to the doctor, but he'd be around all weekend. Henry was well-built, in easy possession of his body. He carefully and politely divided his attention between Anna and me as he spoke. I declined, with regrets. "I'm pretty sedentary," I said, "except for walks in the woods, things like that." "Sure," he said, "no problem." When Anna called out to Bing to say that she'd raised a very nice son, Bing responded warmly in Chinese from the back of the van. Before we left, Henry asked if we might exchange numbers. His father had died last year, his brother lived in Denver and his sister in New York, and his mother was stubborn about her independence. It would be a comfort to know that there was someone just next door. Then one morning in March, I was at my desk when a sound that had been nagging at me as I read from my laptop drifted to the center of my attention. Bing's phone. It had been ringing incessantly, I realized, half a dozen calls or more. It stopped, a minute passed, then it started again. I stood, stretched, and walked out of my office, through the garage, and into the foyer of our house, where I pressed my ear to the wall. When the phone rang again, I could feel it against my head. And there was the sound, too, of Bing's television, played at its soaring overnight volume. But now it was close to noon. I climbed the stairs to our bedroom and walked to the window. No laundry on Bing's line. It was misty and cold, a dark shelf of clouds seated atop the ocean. I felt tired, as I always did at that time of day. I was fully remote, working East Coast hours. And I knew that when I checked my phone, which to prevent distraction I always left charging in the kitchen, I would find messages from Henry. It was inevitable. He'd explained that his mother wasn't answering the phone and he was growing worried. His request that I knock on her door would be apologetic but insistent. And when she didn't answer, of course she wouldn't. Why would she answer her door but not the phone? He'd tell me where to find a key. Soon I would be on the other side of the wall, slowly climbing Bing's stairs, calling her name. I had a bitter feeling about it, as if this outcome, this moment, had been waiting for me since I'd first seen Bing, and by extension, long before that, since we'd found this house in the outer sunset, or since Anna had received the offer to go to California. I watched the ocean for another minute or two, then walked into the kitchen for my phone. Bing's house was a bone yellow. There were no succulents in the ground out front, no gourds or pots or small cheerful things. All the curtains were drawn. I thought she'd put her garbage out on Tuesday, but I couldn't be certain. I'd seen Bing through our kitchen window once, shuffling back from the curb with no walker and the recycling still up by her garage. I'd gone down to offer my arm. She took it, smiling, and we walked together. When I commented on the day, which was cold but bright, she nodded, said something I couldn't understand, then turned her eyes back to the ground. I looked into her open garage. There was a car inside, an ancient black Mercedes that must have been off the road for many years. There were cardboard boxes wilted with moisture, newspapers in short stacks, unused gardening tools hanging on the walls. Now I rang the bell, then pounded on the iron gate. Most of the houses had them, small gated entryways. "No answer," I texted Henry. As my screen registered his typing, I hurried over to Hal and Eleni's and rang their bell. No one home. The driveway across the street was empty. My phone buzzed. I can't reach anyone else nearby. There's a key under the flat stone beside the walk. Again, I'm so sorry, but would you please? Whatever protests I had, that this wasn't my business, that Henry was the one who'd left his poor invalid mother so that he could scale cliffs in Tahoe, and that someone else should be appointed to do this, not me, ran on a distant parallel track in my mind. The key was there, pressed by the stone into the pale, dusty soil. I had to wrestle at some in the lock, but then the gate sprang open. Battered sneakers sat in pairs by the wall of the entryway. Old junk mail lay on the ground. I knocked on the wooden inner door. I called out, "Bing, this is Tom, your neighbor." No answer. But the inner door was unlocked. The sound of the television, caustic at that volume, broke over me as I entered. The lights were off inside, the air close. It was clear that the house's layout was identical to ours. A foyer off the garage on the ground level, living space up on the second floor. I put my hand on the banister at the bottom of the stairs. "I'm coming up," I yelled, though I knew how absurd it was to do so. I would climb the stairs, surface in the living room, and find Bing dead on the sofa in the television's changing light. My lips and face were numb. I had a sense of moving further out of myself with each step. And when I did find Bing, it was almost exactly as I'd imagined, though it was an armchair and not a sofa, and she was seated upright. But what I saw first, before any of that, was the man by the window on the far side of the room. The curtains were drawn, lights off, and because I couldn't make out his features, I thought he was deep in shadow. Then a commercial for tile cleaner threw vivid blues and whites across the room, and I saw that he was wearing something over his head, a tight-fitting black sleeve that covered him entirely from the neck up, something like Lycra, without eye or mouth holes. Apart from that, he wore a gray hooded sweatshirt, zipped up, and dark jeans. He stood very still, hands at his sides, facing Bing. There was no question that Bing was dead. You'd never mistake it. Her eyes were half open, lips parted, hands in her lap and upturned. She wore a thin white robe, feet on the ottoman, and the robe fell open above her knees. I looked quickly. The skin on her thigh shone like pearl. I can remember feeling a confused impulse to smile and apologize to the man for intruding. There were what looked like paint flecks on his jeans, and my mind supplied the rationalization that he could be a handyman. But of course that wasn't right. More likely he was a burglar. Hal had warned me about the roving professionals who loved these old houses. They could drill through the garage doors, trip the wires that ran to the electric openers, steal bikes, tools, anything, and be gone in seconds. And yet, nothing in the house appeared to have been disturbed. The man held nothing in his hands. He hadn't run or made any moves or threatened me in any way. The front gate had been locked and the spare key in its right place. I'd seen no hole drilled through the garage door, unless he'd sneaked in through the back, which was difficult to do. All the yards were fenced off. There were no alleyways. I had no idea how he'd entered the house. My phone buzzed in my hand. Henry calling. What I wanted was to turn and run down the stairs and out into the street. I would run until my chest burst. But I felt paralyzed by the man, by the extraordinary volume of the television, and by Bing. And what if he were violent, this person? I guessed I couldn't turn my back on him. Still, I understood that some action was incumbent upon me. We couldn't stand there forever. So, despite it all, I raised my voice over the television and said, "I'm Tom. Henry asked me to come." The commercial changed again. The room grew dark, then light. I nodded toward Bing. I said, "Henry asked me to check on her." Across the room, the man shifted on his feet. Bing seemed newly dead. There was no odor, nothing like that. It wasn't some awful spectacle, just a fact needing attention. And faced with this unexpected presence, I found myself thinking very clinically. I had told him I was here to check on her, and so now I had to check for breath or a pulse, even if there was no point in doing so. I'd never really taken anyone's pulse. I had the idea of taking my own to rehearse, but I found that I didn't want him to see me do it. My tongue and throat were dry, the numbness spreading through my head. I told him I was going to check on her now. As I moved into the room, he took several steps sideways and back, and in that way we maintained roughly the same length of floor between us. Just as in my house, the kitchen and living room were contiguous, split by a wall with open doorways at either end, west and east. He was hovering now at the eastern threshold, where the floor changed from carpeting to linoleum. I'd only ever stood beside a dead body at a funeral. It upset me to see Bing up close, but I touched her neck with two fingers, as I'd seen it done in movies. Her skin was cool and not unpleasant, and my eyes moved to a framed photo on the wall. Bing and her family in younger days. Henry was easy to pick out, but Bing herself was nearly unrecognizable, tall, slim, and radiant. The friendly-looking man beside her, smiling without showing his teeth, must have been her husband. They all stood around a restaurant table, in suits and dresses, hands on the chair backs. To the man with the head covering, I said that she was dead. I flushed when I said it, looking at his shoulder to avoid the sight of his face. Even in the low light, the fabric must have been sheer enough to see through. He seemed to be tracking my movements, like an owl or an insect. I told him I would now have to call the authorities. Before I do it, I said, I'm going to turn off the television. Then I will open the curtains to let the light in. The remote control sat on Bing's armrest. Once I'd pressed the power button, I saw I'd chosen the wrong order of operations. I would have to cross the floor in the dark. I felt dizzy doing it. I imagined the man striking from the left, but I kept my composure, and when I'd pulled open the curtains and let the day's meager light in, he was there, as before. He'd moved back again a few steps, through the doorway and into the kitchen. We were now a little closer to each other. I could see that the armchair was a maroon suede and that the couch beside it was covered in plastic. On the tray to Bing's right was the last of a meal. I held my phone high and watched him as I dialed. And he began taking long, slow steps backward, deeper into the kitchen. The woman who came on the line asked what my emergency was. I began to explain, but just then he passed from sight behind the dividing wall. The operator asked if Bing was breathing. I couldn't answer. I was too startled by the man's sudden absence, which was even worse than having him there in front of me. In five quick steps, I entered the kitchen on a sharp line from the window. There he was, still moving backward, passing Bing's refrigerator. The operator told me to begin chest compressions. Now I matched each step the man took with one of my own. I couldn't let him out of my sight again. I told the operator that Bing was stiff and cold and that I didn't want to break her ribs, all of which was true. He was nearing the kitchen's western end. No, I replied to the operator. I had not been present at the time of death. Yes, I was able to remain at the scene. He moved backward through the doorway and into the living room, by the top of the staircase where I had entered. Here was his chance to descend the stairs and exit the house. That was what he'd been doing, I reasoned, trying to leave without crossing my path. But he didn't do it. He kept on through the living room, still taking those long, backward steps. He was making a circle. The operator asked if I had any indication that the death was not natural. I didn't know what he was an indication of. It wasn't that I thought he'd killed Bing or that anyone had. But he was no handyman, nor could I believe any longer that he might be a burglar. I hated and tried to avoid seeing the place where his nose pressed against the fabric and the weird hollow at his mouth. The death appears to have been natural, I said. Then the operator asked if I was alone in the house. I was moving now past Bing, and he was by the window again, his hands pale white in the light there. I said yes. It's just you and the deceased, the operator asked to confirm. He passed again into the kitchen. I followed. I said yes again, out of concern for myself, certainly, though I also felt a protective responsibility toward Bing and toward the house. I wanted no confrontation with him. I just had to get through this. Other voices were now on the line, impassive, distorted by static. A dispatcher coordinating with police and EMTs. Help was on the way. The operator asked me to wait on the line with her. I didn't see that as an option, so I ended the call. To the man, I said, okay, they're coming now. And once I'd heard myself say it, I realized it was true. The words buoyed me. All of this would be over soon. They're coming, I repeated. He passed the refrigerator again. I would steer him back toward the stairs. He had to go. This time I thought he would, of course, go down. When he didn't, I saw how very small my understanding of or purchase over all of this was. I began to panic. He moved past the television toward the window, Our circuit was unbroken. The repetition had the character of a nightmare. I told him that he'd be arrested if he stayed, but it came out in a pleading tone, and anyway, I wasn't sure I believed it. The police walking up those stairs and into this, it was like two incompatible realities, and besides, they might not arrive for 8 or 10 or 20 minutes. He knew that time belonged to him. I wanted to sink to the floor and put my head between my knees, but I had the terrible thought that he would just keep on with his bizarre movements, passing me each time he repeated the circle. Bing's landline rang. The sound frightened me badly. Anna and I had been right. The phone was mounted on our shared wall in Bing's kitchen, directly across from where the man now stood. As the phone kept ringing, it struck me that he'd been there with that sound all morning, and just as heedless of it, probably, as he appeared then. Something about that terrified me. How long had he been in the house? I felt I couldn't rule out days or weeks. When he neared the stairs again, it occurred to me that I could run up and push him. Two hands hard on the chest, or one on the chest and the other at his throat, and he'd fall. Maybe he'd break his neck. The numb feeling covered my body and seemed to spread into the space around me. He was at the top of the staircase now. I gathered my breath, tensed my shoulders, but I couldn't do it. Next time, I told myself, I had one whole repetition of the loop to get my nerve up. He moved past Bing, past the television. I felt as if pulled along blindly behind him. There was a bookshelf by the window. Approaching, I scanned it for implements. A heavy brass bookend looked like the best thing, and once I'd reached the shelf, chest heaving and vision clouding, I picked it up. But then, down through the window, I saw the ambulance pulling to the curb. Two EMTs got out. I knocked on the glass. There was the sound of the door from below and then feet on the stairs. I stayed still, and he sank deeper into the kitchen until he was gone from view. I watched the far doorway, the western one, to see if he'd emerge, but he didn't. The EMTs were a man and a woman, dressed in blue, the man with a clean-shaven head and tattoos down his neck, the woman with close-cropped hair. They went straight to Bing, searching for any ghost of breath or a heartbeat. They paid no attention to me. I couldn't conceive of what I might say to them. That someone else was here, yes, but how to render an explanation beyond that? The kitchen was all done in yellow. Yellow print linoleum flooring, pale yellow counters. There were apples in a mesh basket hung from the ceiling, a cereal box beside the toaster. The dishwasher was ajar. And there was an open door in the wall, one that before had been closed. I would have taken it for a narrow pantry, but now I could see that it was a back staircase, cramped and twisting, leading down to what I knew was the garage. The staircase looked illegal, out of code. The wood was unfinished, and I had to turn sideways to enter. I felt for a switch, found none, and began to descend, not at all certain that the steps would hold my weight. The door fell shut above me. In the dark, my breathing grew louder. The brass bookend was wet in my hand. Now I could see nothing, and the texture of the air changed. It was damp and cool and had a mossy taste. Finally, reaching with my foot for the next step, I stumbled. I'd come out at the bottom, into the garage. It was pitch black. I moved in tiny, shuffling steps, hands out in front, and inhaled sharply when they landed on something. The Mercedes, covered in dust and cobwebs. I braced against it, holding the bookend tightly, breathing hard. I could feel him there with me, as if the dark were a substance that joined us. I thought, this is it. Now he's going to do it. Though I didn't know what it was. I kept expecting my eyes to adjust, the car's outline to emerge. But the darkness was total. A rare thing. I set the bookend down on the hood. Then I took my hands away from the car. I let them rest at my sides. The garage became vast. Anna had said once that it fascinated her to have the ocean so near. It was as if infinity were just outside our bedroom windows. I felt something similar in that garage, the perceptual illusion of boundlessness. I no longer needed to announce or explain myself. There was nothing to study or question, and I was too scared to think. In fact, it sometimes seems that I've applied conscious thought to that moment only retroactively. I took a breath and held it. A paradoxical calmness came over me, and what I felt then was that my life was not in me but diffused across the darkness, which was an unbroken field containing everything. Me and him, Anna, the girls, Bing, everything, and so no matter what happened next, there could be no consequence because I had no identity separate from that field. No one did. Nothing did. Everything just was together without boundaries or names. This appeared to me as a plain description of reality and not a moral or personal judgment. I had never felt anything like it, nor have I since. A door opened and light flooded the garage. A police officer stood there in the foyer. Blinking, looking around, I saw that I was alone. What I assume, though I'll never know, is that the man went out the back door and was gone before I even started down the stairs. That afternoon, I sat at my desk, looking over the backyard and down the hill to the ocean until it was time to walk up the hill and collect the girls. Henry knocked on our door that evening. He had driven from Tahoe. Earlier, when we'd finally spoken on the phone, the conversation had been strictly practical. Now I was prepared to face accusations. I almost confessed the whole thing to him in the doorway before he said a word. But instead, he wrapped me in a bear hug, chin pressed into my shoulder. I couldn't sleep that night. Around 4, Bing's motion light flashed on and lit our room. Hal and Eleni brought over 2 loaves of banana bread in the morning. Anna stayed home from work. We dropped the twins at school and then walked up the coast. There were crows everywhere, more than usual. That was a strange thing about the neighborhood, the number of crows. They were enormous and severe against the pastel houses and beach and sky. The day was bright but windy, the path uncrowded. I told Anna how I'd touched Bing's neck, and about the EMTs and the police, and the morticians who would come last to wheel out the body. I told her about the photo of Bing and her family on the wall. And then I told her that there had been someone else in the house when I arrived. Up until that instant, I hadn't quite known whether to say it. And when I heard the words leave me, I felt nervous, almost ashamed in a way I couldn't quite make sense of. It was just that what had happened seemed untranslatable to the bright Pacific morning, to the sound of the surf, to Anna, or to anyone else. She asked what I meant. Who was it? I said I wasn't totally sure. Where in the house? Upstairs in the living room by the window. What did I mean by the window? What was he doing? I felt my neck and ears flush, and one of those mild dissociative clouds passed over me. How strange, I thought, to be here in California, so far from everything I was familiar with. I didn't understand what had happened at Bing's or how to talk about it, and I still don't, which is why I think of it often. The problem now is that I can remember that moment in the garage, but not the feeling of it. It's grown too distant. On occasion, I've come close, when falling asleep, or on the highway by myself, and once in an elevator. A bicycle was coming up quickly from behind us. "Look out," I said, and stepped to one side of the path. Anna moved to the other. We waited for it to pass. I felt tired and sullen, as if my life had gone on too long. I wished I were alone. I thought how simple things might have been if only she'd never told me anything. When we started walking again, I said, "I think he was a handyman. He must have been there to work. I guess he'd had a key." That was all. I'd only wanted to mention it. She asked if he'd spoken with the police. "No," I said, "he'd left before they arrived." It wasn't important, and if she didn't mind, I felt ready to change the topic. I asked her whether she was hungry. We went and had a meal at a nice cafe on Judah Street. That summer was cold and dreary for weeks on end. Henry didn't plan on selling the house, so it just sat there, vacant. I found it harder and harder to focus at my desk, knowing that Bing's garage was on the other side of the wall. By August, we'd made up our minds not to stay in San Francisco. There were lots of reasons. Anna and the girls went first, on a red eye. I spent another week selling some furniture, tying up loose ends. I still had Bing's spare key. The night before I left, I walked next door to her house with the intention of entering. It was 10 or 11, the clouds steely and low, reflecting the city's light. The neighborhood was silent. I stood looking through the gate, holding the key. It was just an ordinary house, I told myself, an ordinary garage. I put the key into the lock, turned it, pushed the gate open. Then a car started down our block. I thought I'd wait for it to pass, but instead the car slowed and pulled into the driveway beside ours. It was Hal and Eleni. I stood with one foot inside Bing's open gate, not at all sure how to explain myself. But Hal just got out of the car and waved. Eleni opened their garage and started rolling out the bins. I closed the gate, locked it, and walked to meet them. We all spoke pleasantly for a while.
That was Zach Williams reading his story, Neighbors. This is his second story in the magazine. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Greg Jackson reads Safari by Jennifer Egan. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice in Apple Podcasts. This episode of The Writer's Voice was produced by Michelle O'Brien. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.